So let's get stuck in. Okay, Kobe. Markets all over the world last week were in a mess. They were turbulent. Their growth was going up and down. Exchange rates were all over the place. What are your feelings on this? What was driving this?
So, Dawn, I think it's much of what we saw, you know, for 2022. Markets have been incredibly volatile, lots and lots of turmoil on markets, and literally markets are trying to price in what the intermittent future could look like for earnings and for cash flows for companies. And that is really driven by the fact that we're seeing inflation, which is just quite frankly out of control in the Western world. And that's maybe quite interesting, because for the average South African investor and for the average South African, inflation in South Africa actually looks quite anemic now. If you just look at the UK, the inflation rate there runs at about 10% year on year, which is a huge number. And in South Africa, inflation runs at now at, let's call it, circa 6%. And the rate of change for that inflation has been absolutely tremendous for Western economies. So quite frankly, they're just not used to this. Because they're not used to it, the economies have become almost used to very, very low inflation over multiple decades. Because that is the case, we're now sitting with these outliers and markets are not quite sure how to react to all of that.
Kobe, when we're talking about economies and the health of economies, gross domestic product is usually one of the measures that is used. And if gross domestic product dips into the negative for two quarters in a row, it's called a technical recession, right? Now, in South Africa in quarter two, 2022, we were negative GDP. And there's a strong indication that we may be negative quarter three again, mostly because of the impact of load shedding. Do you think we're in recession, and how are we faring compared to the rest of the world?
Well, let me put it to you this way, Dawn. I think I'd be very, very surprised if the world doesn't drop into a complete recession and quite a deep recession. I think the UK is on track for a very deep recession for an elongated period of time. I think if you look at the United States, you look at other places, I think it's just a matter of time before those countries drop into recession. If you look at the South African economy, I mean, it's interesting because your technical definition is 100% correct. But remember that we have this added complication in South Africa due to load shedding. And this load shedding is really, really putting the South African economy under huge amounts of strain. And that means we can't achieve our fiscal objectives in South Africa. And because we can't achieve those, all the other ones fall by the wayside. So the socioeconomic objectives and all of the other things. And the social infighting at the political level gets pronounced, and it gets worse and worse and worse because we can't achieve these specific outcomes. So South Africa, absolutely in a recession. Is the world going to go into recession? I'd be very surprised if that doesn't happen.
Great, Kobe. You know, that's the feeling that I've had looking at things over the last couple of months with you. I know that we're going to discuss the role of the Fed in your focus segment a little bit later on, but one of the two statistics probably most closely watched by the US president and that kind of thing is employment. Unemployment and unemployment figures and how many people are employed in a US environment. An American president, and Biden is no exception, always tout, you know, the number of jobs that they've added on a month-by-month basis. And they, you know, for years now, they've seemed to say every single month it's been an increase, with a very small exception over COVID, and then everybody was quiet. So, but if you drill down into the numbers, there's an interesting divergence between establishment and household employment. What are your feelings around employment and how useful an indicator it is of an impending recession?
You know, in a normal economic cycle, employment is critically important. And you're right. From a political perspective, employment is often used as a banner of success. If one looks at political success, look at our unemployment number. Our unemployment number is much lower than the previous regime and the previous dispensation's unemployment number. So therefore, this must be success. The problem that you've got is if you look at the U.S. economy. And you look at the inflation rate running at 8.2% year on year, and in the UK, if we look at that, up at like 10% year on year, suddenly employment is not a good thing anymore, because employment basically allows more and more people to stay in their jobs and continue to spend the same amount of money or potentially increase that money. That really has got to do with wage growth ultimately. And if you continue to have those two dynamics at play, then there's not a chance for inflation to start cooling on the other side. Now, if you speak to some people in the political world, they'll say to you, I'm not going to worry about inflation because this is something that, quite frankly, I can't control. And I'm just going to worry about the well-being of the average of the average individual. If you speak to other people, they'll tell you that if you don't get inflation under control, you're going to start doing damage to your actual economy. But that often becomes the next dispensation's problem, or even the next dispensation's problem. It's not today's dispensation's problem. And maybe that's the problem that we've got in democracies today, is that every 4 or 5 years, you elect new leaders. And as you elect those new leaders, they leave behind them, in their wake, they leave a whole bunch of problems that the new dispensation has to try and figure out. So absolutely, we're going to midterms in the United States at the moment, and employment is a hot topic. It looks amazing on paper, but is it really, really good for the economy long term? Probably not. You probably want to see that number starting to tick up.
Kobe, before we get on to your focus piece on the Fed, can you talk a little bit about the exchange rates and what they're doing at the moment and other indices, maybe like oil and things like that?
Yeah, so I think, look, a lot of what is happening with inflation rates, or sorry, I'd rather say exchange rates globally, is driven by the dollar. The dollar is incredibly strong relative to all other currency units, and that is because it's the reserve currency of last resort. It's the world's reserve currency, and that reserve currency people are putting money into because they're not certain about holding other currency units due to this economic turmoil that we're seeing globally. And let's not forget that there's a Russian-Ukrainian crisis busy playing itself out, and really that ushered in a lot of what we're seeing here today back in February already. So the world is an uncertain place from an economic perspective, and people in the world of uncertainty place money in the dollar. So as much as people will tell us about quantitative easing and tell us that the US economy is really unsustainable at its current debt levels, it is the place of last resort. And when you place money in dollars, you strengthen the dollar relative to all other currency units. And today we have a dollar which is incredibly expensive relative to other currency units across the world. And that dollar value will only start breaking to the lower end when there's more certainty across the world, or when something fundamentally goes wrong in the United States. Either one of those two can drive the dollar to lower levels. And all of a sudden, you'll start seeing emerging market currencies, of which South Africa is one, could potentially then start looking a lot better relative to the United States dollar. But that might still be a while away, because we're sitting in a world of turmoil. And in a world of turmoil, people want to own the greenback. They want to sit and say, listen, I'd much rather own the US dollar. At least I know there's money in my pockets.
Not focus piece on the Fed. Have they really got inflation under control?
Well, inflation, you know, when you look at inflation in the United States, inflation is running, you know, upwards of 8% year on year in the United States. That is a large number. You know, if you think about the target rate for the Federal Reserve, which runs down at like 2%, one could probably argue that inflation is not under control. Inflation, and to bring it under control, is going to need a concerted effort as far as the Federal Reserve is concerned. Now, there's two schools of thought, again, as far as this is concerned. The one school of thought would say, listen, the Federal Reserve should rather be muted in their response and rather let inflation find its natural level and slowly start dissipating over time. But the problem is, when you've got huge employment numbers on side, it becomes very, very difficult to do something like this. So then the question is, what other alternative is there? Well, the only other alternative is you're going to continue to hike rates in order to try and bring inflation under control. The real thing that the US is looking at is the core PCE number. Now, the core PCE number takes away all the volatile elements in inflation, and that number stubbornly continues to be above 6%. Now, if you just take inflation rates, if you just take interest rates into consideration in the United States, the Fed policy rate after this week's or last week's interest rate hikes is now running at anywhere between 3.75 3% to 4%. So that's still below the core PCE level. If you listen to people like Larry Summers, who used to be in the Federal Reserve and has run that shop for a long period of time, he'll tell you that the Fed will have to continue to hike rates above 5% and beyond that in order just to try and make sure that they match the level of inflation in the United States. Now, obviously, one thing that a lot of the policymakers are hoping is that we'll just wake up one day and the PCE number would have dropped significantly below 5%. And that could then be a signal that the Fed actually has things under control. And that hasn't happened. The numbers have continued to be stubbornly high. And as they continue to be stubbornly high, the Fed has no choice but to continue to keep at it. And this is the big verbiage that was used in the press conference during last week. That title, Keeping At It, was actually a book written by a previous Fed chairman called Paul Volcker. Now, for those listeners that don't know who Paul Volcker is the guy that brought inflation under control in the early 1980s in the United States when there was rampant inflation. And previous federal chairmen attempted to try and bring inflation under control by doing different things and trying to be nice to inflation. And Paul Volcker literally came in and he was quite a burly man. He was a large individual with broad shoulders. And he came in and he just literally put up interest rates and continued to do so until he finally broke inflation. And if you listen to the verbiage out of the Federal Reserve, you can see them using the same language as what Paul Volcker would have used and is similar to the book that he wrote calling Keeping At It. They will continue to hike rates until this occurs.
Oh, that's a great insight. Thanks so much for that, Kobe. We're now going to go into the podcast that has just recently been put up onto our website, www.rexalon.co.za. If you don't have any luck there, please contact Kobe or I and we'll point you in the right direction. The podcast this week is on longevity. The working title was Live Long, Die Poor. I know it's a bit tongue-in-cheek, but basically it is the downside and the potential upside of living longer and what you can do to make sure that your money lasts as long as you do. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Rex Salon podcast. Today we're going to be talking about the problem of longevity. Don't think it's a problem? Maybe after this podcast, you'll think again. So we eat right, we exercise, we live longer, but then we die poor. One of the conundrums of modern life is we live longer due to better lifestyles, medical advancements, more tests, quicker tests, and this is almost universally celebrated. We all enjoy the prospect of being around to see our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren grow up and be around for their milestones. There can be no better retirement than enjoying life after years of hard work. People retiring today are not living 10 to 15 years after retirement, but more like 20 to 25 or more. Problem is that wealth advice, on the whole, has not kept up with these radical changes and assumptions on longevity. In the mid-noughties, when I came into this industry, advisors were taught to project retirement savings income out 20 years, and that capital exhaustion was acceptable. There are still parts of the insurance investment industry where this kind of planning takes place. There are also those advisors who advise that a silo approach to onshore and offshore investments be used, and the depletion of local South African investments, is just not prudent, but it's advisable to deplete it. Because, yeah, we all know offshore will more than make up for any capital withdrawals locally. I wish. Why on earth would a broker or advisor even buy into these ludicrous practices? Let's look at some of the background and assumptions. Every year, we get a greater understanding of what shortens life. But this increase in life expectancy has to be funded from somewhere. In countries that have decent government-sponsored pensions, in other words, defined benefit pensions, this is causing a severe problem, exacerbated by the slowing birth rate. In effect, in those countries, they're using pension contributions from the young to pay the old. And estimates made decades ago as how long people would live in retirement are now way out. And this is all going to implode one day. The dramatic wobble in the UK pensions during the trust debacle was a small foretaste of what is to come. By 2030, the last of the boomers will stop contributing to pensions and start expecting a pension themselves, a pension income themselves. The following generations have a low birth rate and are nowhere near the wealth level of their boomer parents at the same age. In South Africa, we do not have a meaningful government pension scheme to fall back on, just to own investments in crude over time, either in a retirement wrapper or discretionary assets. You now also have to assume that you'll live at least 30 years past retirement. So how do you fix this? For salary earners, there are very few options. You have to save and invest more. Most salary earners in decent-sized companies must contribute to a provident or pension fund, and over a working lifetime, that should solve the problem. Not so fast. People are now changing jobs on average every 3 to 5 years, and 90% of them will cash in their provident or pension fund and take the tax lumps as they come. Making that up later, when the kids have left school, bond is paid off, etc., isn't as easy as you think, but it is not impossible. Here are some pointers. 1. Put a date on your retirement. This helps you and your planner determine how you will need to build your wealth toward that date. A goal, if you will. It is just not realistic to expect someone to put the same amount as a percentage of their salaries away the whole of their life, because there are times where there'll be less disposable income than others. And there will be times where you can accumulate more if you're disciplined enough to do so. This is one of the most useful roles of a financial planner today. They help you divert that wealth when it comes and invest it before it burns a hole in your pocket. If they're really clever, they'll make sure that it is flexible so that if life happens, it's not locked up until your old age. Even if you never want to retire, which is quite possible if you're an entrepreneur, you will still need to build up this retirement pot in case your body or your mind packs up before you think you're ready to do so. It happens. Have an idea in today's terms how much you need as an income from your investments. A financial planner can work out the size of capital to produce that, what growth and inflation might be, but they cannot tell you what income you should be pulling down. Only you can do that. To do this properly, you'll have to do a personal income statement. Look, it's called a budget. Nobody wants to do a budget. So let's just call it a personal income statement. And it is going to be completely personal to you. And there's no judgment in it. It just gives the planner a place to start from so that they can help you plan for the future. Life happens. Recessions happen. Jobs are lost. Children fail to launch out of a nest. Divorces happen. There's all sorts of things that happen as a bump in the road for a plan. That is why a plan needs to be a living entity. It needs to change when circumstances change. When there are macroeconomic changes in the environment, it will need to change. When inflation goes out of the ordinary for a prolonged period of time, for example, like it's looking like it's doing in the States at the moment. Those sort of things, a plan needs to be able to adjust so that you can stay on the right track. I often equate this to playing a game of golf. If you stand on a tee and you hit a golf ball, if your swing is out by 1% and you only hit the ball 10 or 15 yards, you're still going to be on the fairway. But that same 1%, if you've hit the ball 200 yards, then you can be in the weeds, and seriously in the weeds. That is why it's important that as time goes along, that you make those small adjustments, and that your plan stays on the fairway. You need to build a relationship with somebody who can keep you on the fairway and out of the weeds, can keep you on the road and out of the donga. Pre- and post-retirement investments should be treated quite differently. pre-retirement funds, especially those more than 10 years away from retirement, should be exposed for maximum growth, both local and offshore. This doesn't mean that you throw everything into a high growth portfolio and come back in 20 years when you need it. But it also doesn't mean that that portfolio needs to be micromanaged. From 3 years out from retirement, the portfolios need to start aligning themselves with their new job, the job to produce an income. This requires quite a different portfolio compared to a growth portfolio, and far more skill and experience in our diversity of asset classes. If you've managed over your working life to build up a critical mass of, say, 8 million investments, but if you just look at a simple heuristic where 1 million rand can produce you an income of 4,500 rand a month, perhaps 8 million isn't the lotto winnings that we all thought it was. So if you've got a critical mass, then you can bring down the costs of your investment by using a bespoke asset manager. Rexulam Invest, we are bespoke asset managers. This is what we do on a day-to-day basis. Those managers manage diversified asset portfolios. They're not just stockbrokers. They don't just look after the JSE. They invest in asset classes all over the world in order to achieve what a client needs. Unit trusts were designed for smaller and growing portfolios. But these should also change when the portfolio is switched from growth to income at retirement. You can also keep down costs by using ETFs and trackers, and most independent financials have access to these tools too. As you get older, your appetite for risky investments and the personal management of them usually diminishes. If at the retirement phase you still want to keep your hand in, then hive off the assets needed to produce your sustainable income, ring fence them, and let somebody manage that. Then you can use whatever is the excess to play with. It should be money that you can afford to lose, but please don't go and leverage it too. Managing income-producing assets is a multidisciplinary approach that requires a blending of asset classes like fixed and variable income bonds, REITs, high dividend stocks, etc., and is beyond the experience of most stockbrokers, let alone retail investors, managing their own portfolio. Income-producing investments usually come in the shape of bonds, with a smattering of dividends and REITs at various times, and with a growth component from stocks to ensure that the capital grows and therefore sustains the income in line with inflation. It is possible just to have a stock portfolio and use dividends, but then the sustainable income should be reduced in line with the dividend profile of the underlying companies. Then you can review this once a year to determine how much more you can extract, if any, from the investment and keep the investment sustainable without capital erosion. This, obviously, because markets go through cycles, that amount is going to change on an annual basis. It's going to change even on a monthly basis, and is automatically, because you want to use this approach, is going to take much of the certainty out of the equation. Prudence. There's no way of getting around it. If you want your investments to produce an income indefinitely, increasing with inflation and without any volatility, then you have to manage it prudently. And this prudence can take several forms. The drawdown on a well-balanced fund shouldn't exceed 5.5% per annum. 4.5% is even better. All liquid assets, local and offshore, should be considered and managed together. Residential property shouldn't be considered as an investment asset. All it does is replace rental expenses in retirement. Other illiquid assets, property, can be built into the plan at a later date if the pressure on the investments are too high and you need to create more liquidity. Capital depletion of any asset bucket, whether it's local or offshore, really should be avoided at all costs. In South Africa, some brokers advise, and I alluded to this earlier, that clients deplete local investments, saving offshore for later. This, frankly, is a recipe for disaster. But don't worry, the Arab broker will be long gone before that flak hits the fan. It's much better to take a prudent drawdown from all your buckets of investments, including offshore, and bring that offshore income back once a year, timing it according to the exchange rate. How and when this is done is the role of an experienced financial planner and should take into consideration the investor's assets, which are almost always unique. Robo-advisors and the Twitterverse and cookie cutter programs used by brokers cannot give you this sort of advice. Offshore investments have the added complication of exchange rate fluctuations, which adds a whole new layer of uncertainty that has to be planned for. It's very difficult to accept a smaller income than you want, need, or you used to at retirement. Who on earth wants to be forced to scale back after decades of hard graft? Brokers will ultimately bow to your wishes and give you the income that you want, knowing that they will be long gone when the investment depletes. Find a trusted planner who will work with you over the years to align your wealth with your dreams. Help you make the uncomfortable choices before it's too late. Look after your investments prudently and holistically, and not leave you with a nightmare in your final years. Let's look at your pre-retirement sources of income. Not everybody can work for themselves, but some people prefer the structure of a corporate environment. Notwithstanding this, working for yourself is becoming easier all the time and has the added benefit that a corporate can no longer dictate your sell-by date. This is one of the major reasons back in the noughties I got out of the corporate environment and into this environment. I was looking at retirement in a decade or so time, and I didn't want somebody to give me a retirement party and shuffle me off to the old age home. Thank you very much. Working for oneself can take the form of contracting or freelancing as long as your skill set is maintained and can last as long as you want. Post-COVID, this has become easier than ever, and I cannot emphasize enough how important it is for every retiree to at least consider this approach. Having your own property portfolio used to be a great panacea of having a passive income at retirement, and in many ways it still is, but it isn't passive at all. The property has to be maintained, tenants managed, utilities paid, insurance paid, defaulting tenants evicted. To add insult to injury, the return on investment isn't great. Ordinary investments like stocks or ETFs, properly invested, are actually far more passive. They can be managed from your armchair without the risk of defaulting tenants. Capital appreciation of property has been stagnant for years. You might as well have owned stocks and taken the dividends. In summary then, if you want to fund your long, healthy life, then the assumptions made a decade or more ago are going to have to change. The good news is that if that change is implemented slowly, it's much less painful than if it's imposed quickly, and it doesn't necessarily end up with a slow-boiled frog. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back again soon. Bye.